Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence by James with your host, Harry Kemsley, and as usual, my co-host, Sean Corbett. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Harry.
So, Sean, today no guests, which is unusual for us recently, but the reason I wanted us to get together is, as we discussed before we started, let's revisit this topic of mis and disinformation. Now, the reason I'd like to discuss it is that I was recently nearly a victim of disinformation. I opened an email that talked about the arrival of a package from the US by a certain courier company that said, as expected, as I was expecting, that it would be needing customs payments made. And it took me to a page that looked astonishingly like the page of the said courier, and it asked me to put my bank details in. And as I started to put my bank details in, I suddenly realized I was about to use the wrong credit card or something. So I paused and I went to try and go backwards in the process, and the buttons didn't work. In fact, none of the buttons around the screen worked. That was what I suddenly realized was the clue that I was about to be scammed out of the cost of the customs fee. Now, the reason I mention it is because that's how pervasive it is. It's everywhere. And I'm somebody that would like to believe that I'm actually pretty good at spotting that sort of thing. You know, I pride myself in being involved in open source intelligence. And yet there I was, staring at what appeared to be a very credible and timely disinformation that was clearly driven by the need for money by somebody that was going to come out of my bank account. It didn't happen, but boy, was I close. I was one mouse click away from sending them a chunk of cash out of my bank account, which would have been really, really annoying.
So that's a really good example, actually, Harry, because people are going to no doubt say, why are you going through the subject again? Well, firstly, because it is incredibly topical, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But the second thing, it pervades every aspect of society that we have in our right. Western liberal democracy, whether that's the individual level that you thought, or at the national level, where there are nefarious actors, some of who are state actors, some who are not, who are trying to shape and obscure, you know, the reality of what we see, and they're in many ways succeeding. This is a really important and difficult issue.
Well, then let's, we tried this once before, and I'm going to try and use it again, this sort of framing questions up front. Let's just put some frame around this topic. So let me ask you a few questions. And the rules for this are you can answer yes or no, one word answers, if you absolutely must. I have borrowed this from another podcast, listened to it, and I quite like the technique. If you absolutely must, you can answer, but only with one sentence.
That'll be a struggle for me.
All right, here we go. You up for this?
Yep.
All right. Do you believe that disinformation and misinformation pose a significant threat to modern society?
Yes.
That's interesting. Very straightforward. Yes. Is there a clear distinction between disinformation and misinformation in terms of their impact and intent?
Yes.
Can an OSINT analyst, an open source intelligence analyst, always rely on traditional methods to identify and mitigate mis and disinformation?
Yes and no.
As I expected, I knew the yes and no's would be difficult. Okay, we'll definitely come back to that then. I do today want to try and spend some time talking about what can we do about it.
Absolutely.
Get to that.
Yeah.
Is social media the primary vehicle for a rapid spread of both mis and disinformation today?
Yes.
Could unchecked disinformation, I've been very specific about the choice of word there, the reasons will become clear later. Could unchecked disinformation ultimately undermine the foundations of Western liberal democracy?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yes. Okay, that's pretty horrifying, but anyway, we'll get to it. All right. Then, because we've done this before, I feel this is potentially redundant, but for those that hadn't heard it, let's start, Sean, with the definition. It is important because I think, as you and I'll talk about in a moment, there's an awful lot of misunderstanding of mis and disinformation, and people are using the terms incorrectly. So how do we define mis and disinformation?
Yeah, it's a really important one, and clearly not enough people have been listening to our previous podcast because they're still getting it wrong. And even within, you know, if you want to call it responsible mainstream media, I call it traditional media now because I don't think it is mainstream media, they're getting it wrong and they're confusing the two and they're obfuscating and using them, you know, juxtaposing with each other. So disinformation is deliberate activity by either a state or non-state actor. So in your case, it could be a scammer, to provide misleading or incorrect information with the intent to mislead, influence, or change behavior.
So there's an intent aspect.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then misinformation is incorrect information shared without an explicit intent to deceive, but often reflecting individual or group preconceived ideas. Now, as we discussed last time with Amil, there is a slightly gray area because, you know, if you're trying to impose your own perspective on somebody, that could be misconstrued as either misinformation or disinformation because you're trying to influence people. So at that individual level. So there is that little gray zone there.
But in that misinformation realm where you're not intending necessarily, yeah, but you are supporting something, you are propagating it.
Yeah.
You are supporting the misinformation by the fact you're supporting it in some way.
Indeed. And you know, you could call it unconscious bias, actually.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit more than that because it's an active way of doing it. I believe this. I've seen something online. I support that. I'm going to share it with people.
So just if disinformation is deliberate and often state-sponsored, while misinformation is usually shared but without a harmful intent necessarily, they both still cause potentially significant damage.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things that has struck me about the mis and disinformation part of our lives, that is such a big part of our lives these days, is how infrequently I encounter teams that are specifically set up to do something about it. In the sense of, okay, great, so there's a problem. What am I going to do about it? And I look into the intelligence world and I don't see necessarily many examples. Maybe there are. This is my lack of understanding of teams trained specifically to identify and to debunk state-sponsored disinformation. Maybe that's something we should be doing. And similarly, in the misinformation realm, which is more pervasive, arguably, because it's probably more social media driven, something that's going on that's actually talking about ground truth and actually equalizing the biases and so on that's showing in it.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, certainly within the classified intelligence world, there is an awareness of that. And you know, and this is another difference between misinformation and disinformation. Disinformation requires a different approach to countering it, whether that is counter disinformation or cybersecurity,
right,
or, you know, just shutting down those outlets, but also a way of actually letting the decision maker know this is incorrect. And I think that's still fairly immature.
Yeah.
Whereas misinformation is a more societal thing and requires the education that is so sadly missing, although people are just starting to get into the net. So there are a few small companies out there that do it. And we spoke to Valent with Amil last time.
That's right.
But it's certainly not as industrial as it should be. And of course, if we want to start talking about the big social media companies, they know exactly what's going on and choose not to do anything about it.
And I guess that's one of those areas we could probably touch on a bit further just now, because if I go back 20 years before the serious advent of social media in the way we talk about it today, well before, I don't know that we were suffering so much then with this pervasive element of misinformation. There was certainly disinformation, but we would have called it propaganda then, I suspect. And around that, the military and intelligence organizations of the world would have talked about operations in the information realm or info ops, psyops, perhaps a slightly more exquisite version of that. But we didn't really talk about misinformation in the way that we do today. So what's changed? Is it just social media? Is it technology has enabled us to have this conversation?
So I think just to nuance that a little bit, so the disinformation thing has always been there, albeit, as you said, in a different term, whether that is propaganda or just deception.
Yeah.
But that's from a military capability to a military capability. And sure. I go all the way back to the right hook from the Marines in the first Gulf War, where the Iraqis thought they were going to come in from Kuwait from the sea. That's legitimate and all the rest of it. But I think now what we're seeing is with the advent of social media, and because no one's allowed to counter anybody else, you know, or you get cancelled or all the rest of it, but it is about the proliferation of social media. And I've got an example here. So talking about the horrible situation that happened in Southport.
Yes.
And, you know, that the rumour coming out that the suspect was an immigrant or an asylum seeker, there was an estimate that there were over 27 million impressions on social media to that effect within 24 hours. I mean, that couldn't happen if it wasn't for literally the degree of that social media. And once it's out, it's the Wild West. It's uncontrolled. There is nothing you can do about it. And despite going, it's not right, it's not true, it's not true, you know, A, people aren't listening to that, and B, the attention span of news outlets, some of them, many of them, and the individual is so short that you've moved on to something else. So retracting stuff is hard. And it goes back to what I always say, and I'll probably say it every single podcast, is, you know, normally the first version of what you hear is not right.
It's not right. So you've got to dig deeper to get
to the truth. And it's that balance between getting to the truth in sufficient timeliness to actually get it out there and everyone believes it, as opposed to, oh no, this has happened in, but we've moved on.
Yeah. I looked at some news reporting around that video back in March 22 when Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, was thought to have been on the TV to say, down these tools, guys, we're going to surrender to the Russian forces, which of course was quickly identified as fake news.
Yeah.
When I looked at the news reporting around it, there wasn't much, and to be fair, by the way, I was looking at traditional news media rather than social media, so there's probably a big difference there. But in the news media, there appeared to be a very, very fast recognition that was a fake video. Now, having watched the video, it isn't very well done, so it's probably fairly easy to spot that doesn't look right.
Yep.
Something about the way he looks, and the way he speaks, the way his face moves and things doesn't look right. But interestingly, it didn't get picked up as a real story, as in Zelensky is surrendering. That didn't come through at all in the news that I saw in trends. It came back very quickly. Fake videos has been broadcast, presumably by the Russian government. I didn't see it on social media, as I've said, but I'm wondering whether we're starting to see an education. People are starting to realise this is a real problem, and then that will start to permeate into the media environment. The media outlets will start to say, hang on a sec, before we publish this apparent news, let's just check its validity. Whereas a period of time ago, that was less the case. Or do you still think it's still a massive problem? We're barely scratching the surface.
I think I'm slightly optimistic, but I would say that the awareness has gone up, you know, because of the things like Southport and it is starting to get into the narrative of the political world, although it's very unsophisticated. And my concern there is that people are now picking their understanding of the world and using information out there to support their so that this is the sort of second and third order of misinformation and disinformation, which is the echo chamber, where you are basically relaying things that fit your worldview, which just accentuates it. And you'll see that in some of the AI algorithms, actually. So whenever, you know, simple example, whenever you Google something, that gets logged. So, right, they're interested in that. Or even more basic, you know, with your shopping trends, if you accept cookies and then suddenly you find that lots of adverts there are stuff that might appeal to you. Now, the counter to that is, you know, I always reject the cookies, but I don't know if I get some strange adverts coming to me, things like for hair care products, which, as you and I know, I'm follically challenged, or makeup, which is, you know, each their own, but it's not my thing. so you can almost cut off your nose to spite your face. But the echo chamber, which some academics say isn't a real thing, it definitely is. I mean, even on, you know, we're kind of old, so I guess if you use social media, probably Facebook, there are people that you are not friends with just because of their life view, shall we say, and you basically filter them out so you don't get them.
I do wonder though, with the echo chamber thing, whether we understand how pervasive that is. I've used that word several times today, but it is a pervasive problem. I sat next to somebody recently. We both put in exactly the same search term into exactly the same search engine, and the difference in our responses was astonishing.
Yeah,
absolutely astonishing. And actually, that point about cookies, it's quite an interesting one, because I know how annoying cookie things can be in terms of the saying, will you accept? If you're saying no, I don't want to accept, it then takes you through three or four steps.
Absolutely, yeah.
And each time you change a page, it asks you the same question, which is really trying to push you into accepting cookies.
Yes.
I don't think people necessarily fully appreciate that that's one of the areas of their lives they have control over in terms of the echo chamber they create around themselves. And as we've said, I think, in a previous podcast, that echo chamber is not being created for malintent. It's being created for commercial reasons.
Making money, yes.
The marketing time they get by you seeing their adverts is what drives the advertising industry to do what they're doing.
But it's quite sinister might be too strong a word, but it is, because exactly as you've said, you're driven to accepting them because you literally don't have enough time in this fast-paced society to say, right, I'm going to go through each one and reject them all. You know, now things have changed a little bit in terms of, you know, there has to be a button that says reject them all, but you've still got to find that button.
Yeah.
So it's easier just to...
I've also noticed recently they've started adding a different category, this thing called legitimate interest. If you get into that, these are companies that have, quote, a legitimate interest in what you're looking at. Says who?
Says them.
Says legitimate according to them.
Exactly.
So you've got to take that out. Well, so long as that's true, then the Wild West continues. So the misinformation problem continues to be a problem. I don't believe, by the way, we're ever going to get that genie back in the bottle.
No,
my view is that we now have to find a way of dealing with it. Now, a long time ago, we talked about data literacy in the broadest and modern sense of that, the ability to discern for yourself what appears to be right and what appears to be something other than right, whether it's wrong or not, you can determine later. What I find interesting, and I guess my scam experience or near scam experience is an example of that, is how easy it is to fall into the traps of what appears to be credible. I mean, certainly the advert, the information came through, was timely and it was exactly on point in terms of the company and so on. But I didn't question it. I took it at face value because it seemed to fit my understanding of the norm.
Right.
And that's what worries me, is that if we've been normalized into our echo chambers and we've become very, very clear about what we think the world looks like and how it works, we're strengthening that bias all the time. We are reinforcing it continuously.
We are, and this is a worry. I mean, you and I have been in this business for a long time, so, you know, we do have that, you know, spider sense, if you want to call it that. Mm. But it goes back again to what Amal was saying, that if so in your case, let's do that one first, actually. You still have the presence of mind to check. You went through, but
I'd like to believe that was the truth. The reality is, it was only because I was about to use the wrong credit card that I needed to go back in the process.
Right.
Ooh. At which point the button didn't work.
Okay.
And that's when my spidey sense went, why is that button not working? Yeah. It's a credible company. And then I clicked on a few other links on the page and none of them worked. They were just literally on the page.
Okay. Because the point I wanted to make was, from an intelligence professional, we'll start to get into that in a moment, is that, you know, this is the difference between the art and the science of intelligence. If you're an experienced analyst and you're used to certain sources and you're used to understanding, you know, how good they are, we do need to talk about sources, then if something's not quite right, then you know to sort of just check it and do that as you should be doing anyway, doing the assurance piece. But we'll come back onto that. But I loved what Amal said in his, that said that be wary of things that make you feel good.
Yeah.
As an analyst, we've all been in the situation where you've got a, you know, you're really proud of an assessment. There's a really important bit that's missing and you can't find it. So you go into sort of second, third, fourth, fifth level of search to try and find it. And then you come up with that's it. That's the answer. Fantastic. I've got it. Now, that's the point you need to go, hang on a minute. This is too good. Mm-hmm. And so then you've got to try and check it, particularly as that source is almost likely to be a single source because you haven't come across it before.
Yeah.
So that is where the art and the science mix, and you've got to go on your experience. Now, you know, I could counter myself here, and you've heard me again several times talk about senior decision makers, particularly military ones, who you've given your best assessment based on incomplete information, which is what intelligence is. And they've gone, no, I don't agree that. I really don't agree that. Based on my military judgment.
Yeah, yeah.
What they really mean is that this doesn't fit my plan and it's not going to get me promoted. Therefore, I'm going to ignore it. Now, I'm slightly flippant, but not very.
Yeah. So I do remember, just change the perspective just slightly here. Go back to that conversation I had with Di some time ago now. We talked about deepfakes and videos.
Yeah.
What I mean from that whole conversation with Di was, effectively, the human eye is now struggling to really discern the difference between real and fake in the video realm. And you talked about the fact that you can only really find fakes by using other AI. So it's counter AI looking for fake AI generated deepfake videos. Well, if my experience, I'm not going to keep talking about the scam too much, but if my experience of the scam let it go by, that's now not just about videos. That's about all kinds of things.
Yeah.
If you send out that email to enough people, as they clearly did, you are going to meet somebody like me who was looking for an email at that moment from that company
right
for that purpose.
Yes.
And that's what worries me.
Yeah.
Is it's very difficult to build tradecraft against something that fits your picture, fits your expectations. Other than, to your point, you should always be questioning yourself. I particularly like the way Emil not only used the line you described in terms of it feels good, check it. He also talked about the fact that when you are looking at a list of news articles and a scroll of articles you could read, the one that you pick, because of the way it's written and titled, of it,
yeah,
is telling you something about the way you're built, the way absolutely you're thinking of the world.
Absolutely.
And then I've now watched myself since that conversation quite carefully, and I forced myself to read things that I otherwise might not have done. And interestingly, my newsfeed is changing. My echo chamber is now changing its focus area.
Absolutely. And you know, going back to sort of the societal, so we, you know, we actually do read stuff and spend some time doing it. And you're right, some of the videos now, I saw a clip of lots of them, and they were ridiculous because they had, you know, Donald Trump being dragged off by the police, although that may not be that unusual. But they had some really, really strange ones. But just in terms of you seeing the video, you couldn't tell that they were fake. Now, for us, we're always going to check that sort of thing. But the TikTok generation, as I call them, you know, the kids that literally look at 15-second clips, if it's more than 15 seconds, they swipe on.
Yeah.
They're just going to see that very, very quick snapshot. And that's their reality. Oh, yeah, such and such, this happened.
Yeah.
That worries me because that is skewing the realities of life.
Yeah, and indeed, as we'll come on to later, perhaps, the democracy we live in. I do remember
indeed
a person I know who makes movies telling me that the average scene length between different camera angle shots for a particular part of a movie used to be measured in minutes, small numbers of minutes. Today, it's measured in small numbers of seconds. If you actually watch a movie from back in the day, black and white, an average scene would last a certain number of minutes, and in that scene, they'd have two or three camera angles, period. Now, in the same scene, they'd have 20, 30, 40 different camera angles because each then clip is only worth 2 or 3 seconds.
Mm.
And they believe that's conditioning the human brain to want to get on to the next scene.
Right.
If you watch an old movie, it does feel a bit clunky because I digress. Let's pivot, Sean, from this acknowledgement of the, I'm going to use the word again, pervasiveness of mis- and disinformation. We talked about the reality of that in terms of a couple of examples. Let's pivot now into the, so why is this important to the analyst? What does this mean for a person who's interested in understanding, quote, ground truth from open sources, and how do they counter it? What are the kind of things that you think of?
Okay, so let's take it up a level then to sort of the strategic world that we live in. You know, the primary task of the analyst is to provide the best possible intelligence, assessed information to senior decision makers or any decision makers, actually, for them to achieve their job. So the case of the national level, you know, what is China thinking? What do they intend to do? Now, the time when you are, you know, you are being fed disinformation at the state level, how do you work it out? And the great example at the moment, I think the best example right now is China.
Mm-hmm.
Within the political classes, you've got two ends of the spectrum, as you always do. But with China, one who says, no, it's all rubbish. They're a good training partner. You know, we need to make money. We need to get close to them. And the other side saying they're the existential threat to our Western way of life. Now, which is true?
Yeah.
You know, and they're presumably getting fed the same intelligence that, as long as it's not politicized, they should be looking at from an objective perspective. So that's part of the make sure that you provide balanced objective assessments that cover all eventualities with the understanding yourself as a politician and your skewed biased views. And we're seeing that polarization of views, you know, it's always been there, but it's never been so pervasive, but also so toxic as we're seeing now.
Is it the responsibility of the analyst to identify that the people they're talking to in terms of the decision makers aren't registering both sides of the argument as they're trying to be presented? Is that the responsibility of the recipient or
so,
both?
So that's, you know, having been on the receiving end of that, that's a really difficult one because, you know, the analyst needs to have a job and they need to basically be listened to and be trusted. And you've only got really two or three attempts before you're never allowed again. But you've got to be objective and you've got to give all sides the story. Whether your customer chooses to take that or not is not really down to you.
Mm.
Now, if you're in a face-to-face situation where you give both sides the argument, you will very quickly probably, depending on the situation, is see the direction in which your decision maker tries to take you with just the way they ask the questions, mm-hmm. at that stage, that's where the personal moral contract comes in. You say, actually, sir, or actually, minister, I don't think that because of this. Mm-hmm. And the key thing is because of this, you've got to qualify what you say. But ultimately, you know, people will listen to what they want to listen to.
Indeed. If we just go back into that, though, just one more time, if I were to receive a question or a task that was asking me to go away and do some analysis to come back with some answers, presumably, from my recollection, you would then break that down into multiple subtasks that would mm-hmm. then become eventually the substance of the answer you might create. So that breaking the question down into relevant investigative tasks is the first step, isn't it, of ensuring you've got a balance of perspectives, balance of sources, a balance of views.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, and you've got to audit trail them. You have to, because if you get to a point in your assessment thinking, right, I'm pretty sure of this, and you can't work back to where did I get that from? So how have I weighted my sources? You know, what are the sources again? How are they cross-referenced, etc.? Then it's your word against somebody else's. So this is why the IC is so heavily dependent, and it's the way that the commercial sector has to go with giving an auditable
right.
way of showing their references. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, I must confess, I've heard that question more than I can remember in the 10 years I've been here at Jane's. In the last few years, I've had the question of, could we have access to your sources,
right.
as well as the steps through the analytical process before you produce the outcome?
Yeah,
I don't remember that being the case when I first arrived. So there's definitely been a change in terms of the expectation. The other thing I would say, though, there is a moment, isn't there, between, if you have the time, between when you've been collecting and validating sources, and that's from your breakdown of the question into the subparts of your question, there is a moment, isn't there, before you produce the report where you come up with your hypotheses, your most likely course of action, those sort of the most likely answers that you're now trying to validate. Isn't that the time when you would probably want to engage with your decision maker or your question?
That's another how long is a piece of string question, because it depends on the nature of the question. It depends on what access you've got to that individual, how much of an intelligent customer they are. I don't mean in terms of, you know, what's their IQ, but I mean it's like, do they understand what makes up intelligence and the fact that it's, you know, that there are different levels of confidence, all the rest of it. So ideally, you'll always do that, you'll check understanding. And there's the timeliness issue as well. So in the military domain, slightly more than the sort of civilian domain in terms of the agencies, you tend to have to do something quickly.
Yeah.
So it's your best assessment in a given time.
Right.
But again, you've got to give this is my level of confidence, and this is why it's a level of confidence. Even that in itself isn't always easy. Certainly there's a couple of great leaders of mine that have said, right, Sean, yeah, I get it. Give me your best assessment.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got to do it. And a good leader will understand that A, that they put you under pressure, and B, that, you know, it might be wrong.
Yeah. And that of course is built on a period of time over which you built up trust. And mutual understanding.
Yeah.
Which of course, in my scenarios, I was trying to paint it, might not be possible in terms of time available. Let me then just twist that just a little bit further into the traditional intelligence gathering methods, which are now much more enabled by technology. You can get sourcing engines to do all kinds of work for you that would have taken a lifetime for a human being, but do it very quickly. You can get summarization tools that will give you the ability to synthesize that down into bite-sized chunks very fast. And indeed, with certain technologies, you can start to detect patterns and use those patterns as a source of what the normal looks like. And therefore, when something stands out from that, you can spot it more carefully. This is all kind of things that technology is doing for the analyst.
Yes.
That should be, from our previous conversations, being about the enhancement of traditional techniques. You're increasing the number of sources you can go to.
Yes.
You are increasing the fidelity of the way you summarize and understand what's in those sources. This is all just about enabling and enhancing the analytical process.
Yeah.
When we listened to Emil and previously to Di in this particular range, I got the sense that there were some very specific new tools coming out or were available that I don't know yet that the analysts that we are talking about, particularly in the military environment, are engaged with or using. And I'm wondering whether the deficit of some of these more specialist detection tools for mis and disinformation are an area that are a weakness for the analysts we're talking about?
That's an interesting question, which I do not know the answer, because not being current, but I would be alarmed if they were not all over this. I really would, because they've got to be. But it does beg more questions, as always, than it answers, because who is assuring that extra source of information? So, you know, if you've got algorithms that are scraping lots more intelligence, who's to say those algorithms are right? And I've been thinking about this a lot. So you and I have both been playing quite extensively, actually, with ChatGPT as an AI model.
Others,
And, you know, it's in some areas, it's really good. Or is it? How do we know that?
Mm-hmm.
But we've learned to trust it, because it kind of actually it does seem to bear fruit. But I do always cross refer. But when you get into something quite specialist, like, you know, we've both got our various different interests out there, it's less granular and certainly less accurate. So because it's specialist stuff, you know, everybody knows I'm a fisherman, so I'll be asking about, okay, what's the relationship between water temperatures and pressure, all that sort of stuff, and you go, that's not right now. Yeah. so how do we know that the stuff that we trust and know is right now? You know, let's not open that particular Pandora's box, but AI has to be part of the solution, but it has to be a part of the solution that we are aware that if you skew the algorithms to start with, you're going to get the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Now, again, my antidote to that, as I've said previously, is that just like a human analyst, you rely on their, you know, they'll tell you once, if they get it wrong once, okay, they get it wrong twice, not good, three times and you're out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same with the algorithms. If it's subsequently proved that, and there has been a few recently quite funny examples, actually, where, you know, you need to put glue on your pizza, things like that, because it's just got something badly wrong. So those will get ironed out eventually, and I'd like to think that they will become assured and trusted. But it's almost a leap of faith, the intelligence community who are struggling this right now, an acceptance that we've got to use all sources and we can't do it manually because there's so much information out there. But how do we trust that AI to actually get at them?
Yeah.
And then there's the ethics element, which we covered.
I do remember that conversation. I think it was with Keith Deer, about it's almost negligent now. Almost, you could almost be accused of being negligent if you are not using these technical capabilities.
Absolutely.
But I think it's fair to say, isn't it, though, that given the competence, the abilities of these state actors in disinformation and the spread of misinformation through platforms which we can no longer control, they are, quote, out of our control, not necessarily out of control in the sense of being completely wild, but they're not in our control anyway, that the analyst has to have techniques to deal with that.
Absolutely.
And they do also need to start gripping and grappling with tools. But what are the kind of the techniques, Sean, that we need to rest on?
And we're getting to the punchline now. So my favourite word.
Tradecraft.
And people go, what on earth are you talking about? You're always banging on about tradecraft. Well, this is absolutely where tradecraft gets it. So you can have the best tools in the world that will collect the data and sort it for you and all the rest of it. But then the analyst has to make some sense out of it.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, much as I talked about the art of intelligence, there's also the science of intelligence. And there's a lot of very well tried and tested methodologies out there and techniques that have been honed over many years. I mean, there's books on it. Not that anybody reads books anymore, but there is. I mean, just a few techniques, just off the top of my head, you know, reframing. So that's where you investigate all possible hypotheses, no matter how unlikely. You might have seen the two poor astronauts that are stranded now up in space, where they had some very unusual noises coming out of their microphone that they sent them back down. Nobody knows what they are. So, you know, almost certainly it's feedback or the signal system. It could be aliens, though. So, you know, exaggerating for effect, but you've got to look at all hypotheses, no matter how unlikely, and then you can, you know, discard some and
time
record it. Absolutely.
Time available.
Exactly. Again, yeah. Then you've got forecasting, which is a tool that uses historical data and past patterns, which I think most of us probably use now to predict future outcomes. Okay, when we saw these particular, you know, situations in the past, this is what happened.
Right.
And this is kind of what we use in red teaming. You know, we'll come up with six or seven different things saying, if that happens and that happens and that happens, then it's likely that this is the capability plus intent, this is what they're going to try.
Is that
do.
Almost like a pattern of life analysis?
Yeah, that's part of it.
It's a pattern of
absolutely. So that's forecasting. And then backcasting, which you know, slightly different, is you evolve backwards from possible future outcomes. So these are the, you know, likely courses of action, mm-hmm. as you would argue. So this is what we think could have happened. Then you work your way back saying, okay, what's the likelihood based on, you know, what we've seen, which is a nuance, but it's quite different from forecasting. Mm-hmm. So there are only three, but, you know, you can do SWOT analysis and all the rest of it, and the combination of all the above. If you are a professional, competent, you know, and responsible analyst, you will be using some of those techniques, not all of them all the time for the time thing, but also, and again, back to my other favorite subjects of all these talking heads on the television who are experts in inverted commas that have basically read the Telegraph based on their background. Go, yeah, that sounds about right. They've done none of that work. Mm-hmm. So how many times have we heard that, you know, Ukraine are about to capitulate, Russia are about to give in, and Putin's going to, and all things in that are just hope. And mm-hmm. as I always say, hope is not a valid course of action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and they're not all the same, of course, because some of them do that work. But
sure.
As an analyst, you've got to do that work, but also show your workings out.
So reframing, forecasting and backcasting.
It's just three.
Yeah, two or three, and there will be others. Now, presumably those kinds of techniques, as we were saying earlier about the use of technology to amplify and to enable, we could also be using tools to make our reframing, our forecasting and our backcasting ever more effective as well.
Yeah, and there will be some apps and tools out there to do it. Again, I'm probably not the person to talk about because I still like Excel spreadsheets and I still like the estimate process, which will even my military friends will be really, but it works. But as long as you've got a technique that you're comfortable with, that you know you're looking at all the different factors that you need to. So, you know, do you remember the evaluation of factors?
Yeah, of course.
And you'd list them to death and then you'd say, right, is that relevant? Is that relevant? Is that relevant? So as long as you've got a methodology that encapsulates it all, then you're good to go. But, you know, I'm sure the clever analysts outside there will go, oh, yeah, I do that. But here's the particular tool on the app that I use to do it.
I'm just going to change it slightly now. Isn't there a value in seeing what disinformation an organization, a country is pushing out? Doesn't that give you insights in some regards?
Very much so. And this is the other side of the equation. I've been doing quite a lot of work on North Korea, actually. And we did a really good podcast with Christine Variali.
Yes.
And she was saying, as much as it's a closed society and there's not a lot of open source intelligence, and we're going to follow this up, by the way, you know, you can tell to an extent, what nation is thinking by what it puts out there as propaganda.
Yes.
Or, you know, if you're in the sort of more nefarious domain, you know, what are they attacking in terms of a cyber perspective? So, you know, if they're probing your, you know, electricity system, for example, I'm using that as hypothetical, mm-hmm. then you'll think, well, okay, they're just testing where the weaknesses are, etc. I mean, you could even take it as far as taking it to and this is an interesting one, but it's more of a physical thing. So when Iran retaliated for the last strike that killed one of their representatives in Syria, they sent a whole load of drones, all the rest of it, and it didn't get through.
Yeah.
Now, you could say the question, was that because they just weren't very good, or the defences of the Israelis and allies was good, or were they just probing and testing?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't know. So that's a sort of physical example. But, you know, in the electronic domain, that is just as reasonable. But from a diplomatic and a propaganda perspective, and will you recall, we had a discussion with Claire Chu, who actually went on a trip there.
That's
and
right.
She was saying it was fascinating what people said and how they said it, to understand not just what they were trying to message, but how they thought as well.
Yeah.
So in the absence of, you know, the real intelligence, it does give you a really good idea about where people are coming from.
So don't dismiss disinformation.
No, absolutely not.
Use it as a resource as much as any other.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, look, as ever, Sean, we've chewed up through 40 odd minutes almost without a blink, I think, there. What I would want to do with this conversation, though, from where I'm sitting, Sean, is I think we need to recognize that mis- and disinformation is now the genie out of the bottle. It's happening.
Yeah.
Disinformation has been there in one form or by one name or other for a long, long time. But misinformation, which is affecting at the society level, is something that we all need to start thinking about. And for me, whether you call it data literacy or you're just talking about your spidey sense and thinking this doesn't feel right, I don't mind which it is, but we do need to start thinking about how we embrace and deal, mitigate with this whole problem? Because it's not something that's going to go away. It seems to me in the recent years that it's accelerated. We've got more and more misinformation channels and more acceptance of misinformation that is driving people further and further away. And I've heard the phrase, the US is very polarized. Well, they're not unique in that.
No, they're not.
And that polarization, by whatever means it's being created, is being, it seems to me, reinforced. I read a fascinating book in recent times, a book, I can't remember the author's name now, it doesn't matter, but I can't remember the name, Everybody Lies.
Yeah.
And he talks about the fact that people who you might expect to be looking and reading certain things are actually doing exactly that. They're also on other sites. You've got the same people who are very right-wing talking to left-wing outlets and vice versa, which does kind of counter the echo chamber argument a little bit, but I'll push that to one side. But what I do notice about that is, even if the exposure to other forms of thought, other viewpoints is fleeting, it's better that you're getting some side of its alternative perspectives than none at all. Because the more you become steeped in your own view of the world, the more the marketing algorithms of the world you're living in, the social and other cyber means, is going to reinforce that.
Absolutely.
You've really got to get on top of it.
And you've got to work at it as well. I deliberately look at some sites that I don't really like, just because it's not my politics, to see the counter perspective, because it's really easy to get into that filter bubble, echo chamber, call it whatever you will, and just take, that's what I think. And it makes you feel good. You've got to look at the other side.
Isn't it fascinating, though, to do that? How you can feel the adrenaline start to rise,
and
you start to get more and more agitated by what you're reading and the need to counter it. That is a symptom for me, which is my takeaway from this podcast, by the way. That symptom that you feel in yourself in terms of a reaction, something you want to read and something you want to revoke or to rebut, that is telling you something about your view of the world.
Indeed.
And if you're not conscious of that and you're letting yourself just unconsciously be driven along, who knows where this conversation goes.
Right.
John, your takeaway?
My takeaway is that I think this is a really serious issue. And, you know, I don't normally use the word existential, but this is a potential existential threat to the Western democratic way of life. You know, we talk about grey zone warfare, which is undoubtedly going on at the moment from the Chinese, from the Russians, from the North Koreans, from the Iranians against Western society, trying to increase that polarization. So this is disinformation, not because it's absolute, and it's working. It really is. You look on any given subject and there are very, very defined viewpoints, to the extent that, you know, we have had, you know, riots and demonstrations on both sides, you know, which not necessarily always gets. So you've got the social, the mainstream media have a responsibility here that they are really shirking right now just for clicks. But this, you know, without firing a shot, China, Russia et al. could actually win the next world war just by continuing that, making that happen, and getting such a disgruntled population that A, you don't believe anything, or B, you only believe what you hear because you've heard so much misinformation, disinformation. And, you know, there are politicians who are responsible for this as well, you know, fake news, you know, based on what? How do you know? Some of it might be, but some of it isn't. So straight away go, I support that person because they support mine, and they say that there are others fake news. So not everybody is, you know, as obsessed with getting the right information as we are. So, you know, you have a look at, you click on whatever, your social media, go, yeah, right, and then move on. You know, most people don't care, hopefully, enough to act on any of this. But, you know, I could see a position in the next 5-10 years where, unless we do something that is, it's got to be education, you can't force it because it just reinforces that polarization, that we are in a position where, if nothing else, you know, Western liberal democracies are catatonic because they can't act on anything, which we might be seeing now. Or at worst, you know, the Chinese or Russians roll their tanks in and nobody either knows it's happening or can do anything about it. Okay, exaggerating.
We're just saying that's a conspiracy theory.
Indeed. So, but no, being serious for a moment, it is a huge threat to our way of living and to, you know, how we run our democracy. And I guess the bottom line is this is why it's so committed to analysts getting it right and using that trade graph, because somebody at some stage has to be the grown up in the room and come up with objective, well-balanced, well-researched, fully, you know, with all the data assessments and say, this is the truth.
And that's all about, for me, the open source environment, the mm-hmm. one that we are talking about a lot on this podcast, but also that increasingly now a lot of people are becoming aware of the power of that. For the audience listening, for the listener, if you have any questions about this, or indeed any comments, we've noticed, Sean and I, in the recent months, how many more questions we're getting these days than usual. So if that's a sign that you want to get more engaged in what we talk about, or indeed make a comment about what we've said, feel free. We are very much up for that. We've had one listener on as a guest, and she was very, very good as a guest and gave us some interesting insights into the tool sets that she's working on and so on. Very happy to engage on that basis as well. So please do send us your thoughts, send us your questions, and we'll happily pick it up. And until then, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.